Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Liz Mealy.
And I was like, you know who knows about dog balls? My dad.
That and more. But first, if you are anywhere near New York or LA, pitch us for our fall live shows. Story themes for those shows are surreal or eek. But even if the words surreal or eek bring no memories to mind, pitch us something anyway at risk-show.com/submissions.
We'll be right back.
If just thinking about your bills makes you feel confused and disorientated, like your head is full of raspberry jelly, then you need Monzo. Download your new favorite bank and pay bills from custom pots. Money never felt like Monzo. UK residents, T's and C's apply.
Now here's the show. Folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is Brijan behind me now. And we're calling this week's episode Cutting Ties. It's kind of an ironic title, since both stories are also about becoming more integrated. Whew, I'll tell you, speaking of that, I just returned from 3 weeks away. I took my third major workshop on the subject of life coaching. So now I've taken one in Ericksonian hypnotherapy, one in International Coaching Federation style coaching, and this latest one was on something called generative coaching. And it was By far, one of the most profound things I've ever experienced. I've had therapists and coaches tell me before that it's really good to learn different styles because you'll have more tools in your toolkit. And now I finally feel like, wow, yes, I have some profoundly powerful tools, and I'm just feeling this delicious confidence now that I can help myself and help others with all this that I've learned. So I'm going to record a Patreon check-in soon and make it free to all so you can hear what these past 3 weeks have been like for me. Did I miss anything, by the way? Anything happen these first few weeks of July 2024? All right, in a little bit, we're going to hear from Rick Haney, a beautiful story about grief and synchronicity. But before that, a story from Liz Mealy that she recorded for us last March at the Risk Live show at Caveat in New York City. Here's Liz Mealy now with a story we call Biggest Balls in Brooklyn.
I'm working on it. 2 months into the relationship with my boyfriend, out of nowhere, he was like, I think I'm going to get a vasectomy. Which I feel like you should probably know a little bit about my boyfriend to understand the rest of the story. He's a pretty unconventional dude. He's completely covered in tattoos. His nose is pierced. His tongue is split. And he does this thing called suspension. Sure, silence. Great. Okay. Essentially, they put hooks in their skin, like their back and their legs, and they dude, that's how I feel, all right? He's telling me all of this on our third date, and I'm freaking... Dude, I have giant anime eyes. I don't know how to hide my feelings. He's looking at my eyes, and he's like, I don't do weird sex stuff. And I was like, I wasn't even there yet, all right? Freaking out. But what you should also know about him is he doesn't drink. He's never drank. He doesn't do drugs. He doesn't smoke. He doesn't even drink caffeine. And the whole time he's telling me this, I was like, just do drugs. Dude, the feeling you're chasing is drugs. You don't need to do this. That's crazy. Like, why? Everybody else is getting on a plane to their destination. You're walking barefoot through a thorn bush for miles. Just say yes to drugs. That's my boyfriend. So, this is the thing. I'm 38. I've never wanted to have kids. He's 40. He's never wanted to have kids. We kind of talked about it once. That's not the issue. The issue is it felt early for us, right? Like, it felt like he got to know me a little bit, and he was like, I don't think I want to make mistakes with this one, right? It felt personal. It felt hurtful. But it was fine. So the biggest thing is... with vasectomy doctors, there's two camps of doctors. There's ones that do a twilight anesthesia, and there are ones that don't. And this one did a twilight anesthesia, and you need somebody to pick you up. So he's like, hey, will you come with me to this vasectomy? And I was like, of course, I'll take the day off, which is hilarious because it's 2 months in, and he doesn't know I don't do anything. Right? Like, but he doesn't need to know. I'm a hero, right? I was like, I'll clear my schedule. I'm with you. I'm with you, baby. So... I felt like we did research, right? Like, he talked to a bunch of my male comic friends. He talked to a bunch of his friends. I come from a medical family. I did a little bit of Googling, and I thought with all the medical family, both my parents are veterinarians. My sister is an emergency room nurse. My brother-in-law is an EMT and firefighter. I read half an article. I was like, I get this. My parents get this. We're fine, right? So, and it's supposed to be easy, by the way. They call it snip snip. All of our friends were like, it's a 10-minute procedure. You go home, you put frozen bags of peas on your dick. You make dick jokes. We were prepared for nothing. So the day we get there, we're both in a good mood. I'm like making jokes. Like, I have to fill out my relationship to him. I was like, best girlfriend ever. High-fiving the nurse. And it's fine. It was a 10-minute procedure. It went great. So I bring him home. The anesthesia starts to wear off, and he starts vomiting everywhere. And he ends up vomiting 4 or 5 times. I'm cleaning up his vomit, and I'm like, this isn't why I took off, right? It is why I didn't want to have kids. Great reminder. Great job, babe. And he starts to tell me he's in excruciating pain. He says he had a level 8 pain. And if you don't remember, covered in tattoos, things are pierced that shouldn't be pierced. He understands pain, and he's not doing okay. So I call up the nurses, right? And I'm going to say this. I have a lot of empathy for these nurses. These are vasectomy nurses. They are getting calls every single day from men who are feeling pain for the first time. And they could give a fuck. They did not care at all. They're like, he's fine. And I was like, I don't feel like he's fine. They hang up. I end up calling them 4 or 5 times to almost no response. So I'm freaking out a little bit. And this is the thing. Over the course of a couple of hours, his balls swell to the size of a grapefruit. And over the course of a couple of days, he swells and bruises from his hips to his asshole. Whatever you're imagining, it's 10 times worse. So I don't know what to do. So the first thing I can think of is I call my sister, right? And the other thing is, like, we start Googling, right? And I know you shouldn't Google. We all know you shouldn't Google. And it starts to look like he has scrotal hematoma. And all the pictures are of dog balls. And I was like, you know who knows about dog balls? My dad. So I call up my dad. And My dad's incredible, by the way. My dad's amazing. He's telling me what he thinks is happening. He's telling me what he's telling me what to expect next. He's telling me how to take care of him. I don't know what to do. I'm super overwhelmed. I'm like, should we put him down? And finally, the nurses do call in a prescription for Percocet. And I give him the Percocet. He does start to feel better. He's like, drugs are great. I was like, I told you. And we get through day one. And we end up going to the doctor the next day, and he confirms that it's scrotal hematoma. He must have hit a blood vessel, and it's super rare. He's like, hey, there's less than 1% chance. Everything that could have gone wrong has already gone wrong. It's just gonna have to heal on its own. That's what he's like, the worst is over. But he does say, if it does get worse, you're gonna have to go to the ER. So we go home, we're feeling not great about it, and I end up taking care of him for a week. Like, he doesn't, you know, it's kind of hard for him to walk. But the biggest, I don't know if you can tell, I'm not a great caregiver. I don't know what I'm doing. I would say my best asset is like making people laugh sometimes and making them feel comfortable. So like every time he tries to get up, I'm like, you got big ball energy, biggest balls in Brooklyn, like whatever it takes for him to feel good about his new situation. But we're getting through the week, and at the end of the week, I have to do a gig in Connecticut. So I go to Connecticut, and as I'm driving home in the middle of the night, he calls me up and he goes, I don't know, something doesn't feel right. I think it's getting worse. I think we need to go to the ER. So we get up the next morning, we get up super early, we're sitting in the lobby of the ER, and he turns to me and he's like, don't be weird, but I wrote down that you're my wife. And I was like, why would you do that? He's like, I just feel like they're not gonna let you back there with me if I don't tell them that you're my wife. Is that okay? And I was like, yeah, of course. And it's like, sure, right? He's nervous, it's scary, he doesn't wanna be alone, but like, this isn't how I envisioned it, right? Like, I didn't, you know what I mean? Like, I thought it would be in a better place. I thought I would know him better. I thought his balls would be smaller. Like, this isn't how I thought I would be proposed to. Also, I don't know how to be a wife, right? I barely know how to be a girlfriend. Like, do I yell? Like, how do I get ready to be I'm looking for lipstick. I'm trying to find a monologue. I am so stressed. And so finally they call us back. We're walking back to where it's like a little vestibule. There's like a bed. There's like a little curtain. He puts on a gown, but there's really nowhere for me to stand. So I'm awkwardly standing outside this bed. And this nurse comes over and she's like, who are you? And I was like, his wife? It felt incredible, by the way. Like, I get it. I totally understand. I'm like whispering to myself. I'm like, I'm a wife now. He's like, are you all right? I was like, I'm a wife. He's like, what? A couple hours go by. Finally, a doctor comes over. He lifts up his gown and he's like, whoa. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. And I was like, biggest balls in Brooklyn. And he's like, yeah. And he goes, can I take a picture? And we're like, sure. He goes, the urologist is upstairs. I want to take a picture. I'm going to show him. And when he's ready, he's going to come down and talk to you. So we're like, okay. But then he just takes out his cell phone. Am I wrong for believing there's like a doctor camera that doesn't leave the facilities? Now my boyfriend's balls are next to pictures of like his niece and cupcakes. Dude, he walked away. I was like, $10 says by the end of the day, your balls are on the internet. Right? Like I'm gonna be scrolling through Instagram like, honey, I think your nuts are going viral. I recognize these nuts. So after a couple hours, they end up taking him upstairs. They wanna do blood tests. They wanna do a sonogram. So he's upstairs for a little bit, and I'm just sitting on the bed hanging out. And finally, I see the doctor talking to the urologist. But the urologist is wearing a winter coat and he has on a backpack. And he starts walking away. And it just feels like he's leaving. So I run after him. I was like, hey, are you gonna talk to my husband? He's like, yeah, I'm going upstairs to talk to him right now. And I was like, fucking yeah, you are. So I turn back to the doctor. I don't even know what I said. I like asked him a question. He answers it. And then he just starts going into everything that they're doing. They're telling me all the tests they're taking. He's telling me everything that they're worried about might be happening. He's telling me the best way to take care of him. I'm getting overwhelmed. I'm like, should we put him down? He's like, do you mean anesthesia? I was like, no, I mean euthanasia. He's like, I don't think you do. I was like, no, I'm a wife now. If I want to unplug him, that's my right as a wife. He's like, I don't know if you're someone's wife. Eventually, they release him. They say that he's fine. They say that it sucks right now and that he's just going to have to heal on his own. And we go home and we just kind of feel defeated. And the truth is it took many more doctor's appointments and many more months for him to heal. And I remember once somebody told me that a true marriage, like you don't actually have a real marriage until you have kids. Because there's something about like child rearing that really bonds a relationship. And the more I thought about it, I just felt like after months of caring for my boyfriend and his balls, I would say one, I feel like our fake marriage is very much real. And I would also say that our journey of not having kids probably bonded us faster and stronger than any relationship I've had before. So I do feel like marriage is a commitment, and I do feel like any partnership is a commitment. But I don't feel like having kids is the way that you need to be committed. I just feel like a real committed partnership is when you see something messy happen in your partner's life. Instead of being like, ugh, you just kind of roll up your sleeves and you try to join them in that mess. So that week, we had this messy situation. We come home from the hospital. And I had told my entire family, by the way. I don't know if that's clear. Every single person in my family was doctor-esque. I told everybody. And my family was incredible. Like, my mom would text me every day, just two ball emojis. I would text back two bigger ball emojis. But he never told his parents. And I just was like, dude, I don't know. I just feel like they need to know. So he calls up his parents. And so you should probably know that he's an only child, so they, like, really love him. And they're being so nice. They're like, oh my God, do you need us to come over? Do you want us to take care of us? He's like, no, Liz is taking care of me. I was like, I'm a wife now. He's like, you gotta stop. But he ends up putting them on speakerphone, and they just go on and on. They're just so gracious. They're like, thank you so much for taking care of our son. We don't know what we would do without you. And there's just like this lull in the conversation where I'm supposed to be like, sure, or my pleasure, or, you know, his balls will be normal someday. Like, just something to make everybody feel safe. But instead, I just go, he has the biggest balls in Brooklyn. And his dad was like, I knew I had to get dethroned someday. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
Folks, I want to tell you about a podcast I think you're going to love. Talk is Jericho sits down with some of the biggest names in comedy and entertainment as your host, professional wrestler Chris Jericho, interviews comedians like Gabriel Fluffy Iglesias and Marc Maron, who you've heard on Risk. If they're funny, they're on Talk is Jericho. Follow and listen to Talk is Jericho on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back.
This is Risk. This is Horse Beach behind me now, and we just heard a little AC/DC, but before that, a story by Liz Mealy, who's on all the socials at Liz Mealy, and whose latest comedy special is free on YouTube, and it's called Murder Sheets. Folks, we have a new bonus story over on Patreon this week from Jen Curcio. It sounds a little bit like this.
I took a whole weed candy bar and a whole weed Jolly Rancher, and they're like, oh my God, that is too much. You have taken too much. And right then it hits me, and I'm like, oh no. And I start looking around at all these couples, and they're dancing, and they're making out, and they're grinding because it's New Year's Eve. And I'm like, they're all going to get AIDS. Unless I tell them to have safe sex.
And there's plenty more where that came from at patreon.com/risk. We dearly appreciate your support over at Patreon. Please keep it coming, because without it, we really and truly would not be able to keep the show running. Next, we're going to hear from Rick Haney, a voice actor, writer, musician, and storyteller whose Little League coach was Stephen King. Here's Rick Haney now with a story we call Life is Fucking Awesome.
I think depression and addiction, at least in my experience, go hand in hand. I can't speak for everybody, but when I think about some of the major events in my life, the fall of 2016 and the winter of 2017, that's when I felt my absolute worst. I was prescribed benzos for an anxiety disorder, but at the time I didn't realize how depressed I was. A lot of it was situational. But the root of it was the fact that as a human being, as a father and as a husband, I felt like I was letting everybody down. I was really miserable in the work that I was doing. I was working at a radio station and was not at all fulfilled. Going to work every single day when you've got nothing left to give, you're completely devoid of not only motivation, but the energy to do what you need to do. I wouldn't wish that upon anybody, but in those days, that's exactly how I felt. And knowing that I couldn't fit in at a traditional 9-to-5 job, the crippling panic attacks, the sudden mood swings, I just felt like with every job that I had had, I knew it was going to end in disaster just because I couldn't control my emotions. And so after a few months of catastrophe after catastrophe, I decided that the best option for me to make money was to drive for Uber. I wouldn't have a boss. I didn't have anybody to answer to, and I could cash out immediately. And if it meant that I could be alone in my car all day long, people would leave me alone, maybe have a conversation every now and again with strangers, I could handle that. And so that's what I did. By February of 2017, I had pretty much hit rock bottom with my addiction. I was so strung out by the grip that these benzos had on me that I couldn't even go downstairs without knowing there was a bottle of pills in my pocket. It was a combination of paranoia and the I don't even know how to put it into words, like the feeling of insurmountable grief that I had been dealing with in the months prior that really just kind of shut me off from everybody else. I was so worried that my wife was going to leave me, that I was raising children who would grow to be disappointed in me. And we were already living with my in-laws because things had been so bad. I felt like I was a burden on them, and I just couldn't climb out of it. And by February, I was just feeling like I was standing on the edge of a cliff. And what really took the wind out of all my sails was the fact that my parents had grown old enough to retire, and part of their plan was to sell my childhood home and relocate to warmer climates. In this case, it was Charlotte, North Carolina, where my two brothers had long since settled. The thought of not having my home, you know, the one place I could always go to when times were tough, I was so afraid of losing that connection, I didn't know what to do because I couldn't talk about this. That's the one thing about depression and certainly addiction that a lot of people struggle with. being found out, being discovered. And that's exactly where I was. At the same time, I was with it enough to understand that this was what my parents needed. And I loved my parents. I still do. And I knew how much this meant to them. I knew that my dad, as he was getting older, he was having a lot of health conditions. And I knew that the Maine winters were going to be too much for him. I just knew that they needed to be somewhere else. So I choked back a lot of tears and did everything I could to make sure their transfer into this new chapter in their lives would go as smoothly as possible. But it was incredibly difficult for me. This one day, probably the last day I was in that house, I was packing up some boxes from the basement. And in our basement was a bar room. We had a TV and a stereo and a bar my dad had built when I was a kid. I picked up this box to bring it upstairs and load it onto the truck. And a single picture fell out of this box. It fluttered down to the floor, and as I looked at it, I could see it laying there on the floor, and I recognized it immediately, even though it was a picture I had never seen before. So I picked it up and I studied it for a moment. It was a picture of my grandparents' old house in Brewer, which was the next town over. I saw my grandfather's old International Scout parked in the driveway, the cedar hedges my cousins and I used to hide in, the lamppost that flanked the walkway between the driveway and the front door. I recognized things immediately. And what struck me the most was seeing my grandfather standing in the big picture window overlooking the front yard. He stood there with his hands on the windowsill with this smirk on his face. Almost instantly, I was transported back to when I was 5 years old. And this sadness, grief that had taken over my family when he passed away. Just from staring at this one single picture, I was reminded of being that five-year-old again and not being able to process any of these emotions. But what I did remember was that in the coming years after he passed away, I remember talking to him as if he were in the room with me. He and I did everything together. He took me for haircuts. We went shopping. We had matching blazers that we would wear whenever he took me anywhere. And he even let me drive that Scout, standing on his lap with my little hands on the steering wheel. I was looking at this picture as a grown man being reintroduced to things that I had been burying for 40 years. And standing there, I couldn't help but think of all of that sadness and how I used to talk to him. And it would be great if I could just talk to him one more time. I was floored by the emotion of this one single picture. So like I did when I was a kid, I just felt compelled to talk to him again. And I was like, hey, Grandpa, remember me? It's been a while. Things just, I don't know, they just got all fucked up and I need some help. I'm having a rough time with all of this. I've never felt more alone in my life. And as I'm kind of mumbling to this picture all by myself, somebody came down the stairs into the basement, and I took the picture and put it into my pocket and went on with my day. And that was the last time I was ever in that basement. Well, a couple weeks went by. I was driving for Uber, and I had picked up a guy who lived in a neighborhood that was a complete clusterfuck. I couldn't figure out how to get out of it. He had to guide me in. And the guy just got under my skin from the moment he got in my car. So by the time I dropped him off, I was feeling incredibly agitated, not to mention lost. So trying to get out of this neighborhood was just this double-edged sword of frustration and anger. Eventually, after turning so many different ways and U-turns and all these different things where I had to figure my way out of this neighborhood, I ended up on Lorraine Avenue. And that took my breath away. Because on Lorraine Avenue was my grandparents' old house, which I had been thinking about for the last 2 weeks because of that picture I had found. The house is like 100 yards away. So I'm driving down Lorraine Avenue, and then it's right in front of me. Here it was, completely modernized, fully grown trees that weren't there. And I was squinting at the darkness, just kind of looking at this old house, and started to see things that indeed I did recognize that hadn't changed. There was a brick facade around the garage, 1960s architecture. The lamppost that used to have a sign on it bearing my mother's maiden name, that was still there, even though it was a lot more crooked than it was the last time I had seen it. This was a very modern looking house, but I could still see relics of my grandparents, and that kind of made me ache. But the last thing I looked at was the picture window where my grandfather was standing, and I could just barely make out the outline of a shadow. Somebody was standing in that window looking back out at me, and this was almost at midnight. And so I just kind of froze. And I just went, holy shit. Is that Grandpa? That might be Grandpa. Jesus, get it together. That's not Grandpa. Whoever that is going to call the cops. And I thought, no way, man. That could be my grandfather. I need to believe that that's my grandfather. When I deal with really deep emotions like this, it always leads to anxiety. And I could feel a panic attack brewing. I started just feeling really anxious. And it always starts in the pit of my stomach, like an icy tidal wave that just kind of barrels its way up into my chest and into my shoulders and out my arms and hands and fingertips until I just start like trembling. I had tears in my eyes and I was incredibly emotional. I looked up at the window again and I saw the shadow, but this time it was kind of backlit as if somebody had turned on a nightlight in the far corner of the room. And it was like a glow. It outlined perfectly the shadow and shape of whoever was standing there. And they had their hands resting on the windowsill, exactly in the same position that my grandfather was in the photo. Holy shit. It's really him. That's really him. Oh my God, I can't. There's no way that's not him. This is my shot. This is what I've been wanting my whole life. If I talk to him now, maybe he'll say something back or give me some sort of sign that I'm not losing my shit. This is it. So I started talking to him again.
Hey, Grandpa. I just hope you can hear me. And if you can give me something to let me know I'm going to be all right, I'd really appreciate it. I'm so tired. I'm tired of goodbye. I'm tired of feeling like this is it. I want to be a good dad. I want to be a good husband. Please, please help me. I just can't do this anymore. Please help me.
And then my phone went off. It wasn't a text message. It wasn't a phone call. It was a goddamn Uber request. And I looked at the phone and froze. Every hair on my body stood straight up. The pickup address was my parents' old house. And I don't know if I fainted or I know I closed my eyes, but I didn't know for how long. But I opened my eyes again and felt like I had just woken up from a nap, like on a warm summer afternoon. All the anxiety and all of the angst and shit that had been swirling around me, not even a minute before, felt like it had all just washed away. It was like a warm summer rain was falling down upon me, but instead of rain, it was like this unbelievable sensation of love and joy and gratitude and the belief that nothing was impossible. And so I was sitting there in my car, staring at my phone, and I almost felt instantly like transformed. And I couldn't explain it. I didn't know how to put it into words, but in the moment, it felt like God himself had placed me in a bear hug. And I felt like everything was just going to be all right. And I looked down at my phone and realized that the Uber request was still there. These things usually expire if you don't answer them within like 5 seconds, right? How in the world is this happening? Which made me fully understand that all of the emotion that had completely dissipated and gone away had to have occurred in the span of less than 5 seconds. Which, in the moment, I couldn't even compute. And so, when I realized all this, I thought, I can do this. I know I can do this. And I put my foot on the brake, shifted into gear, and drove over to my parents' old house, which 10 minutes ago, I hadn't even been able to drive on that side of town because I was so broken by them leaving. It was like my tires weren't even on the ground. I felt like I was floating. So I get to my parents' former home, and I'm taking in all of these familiar things. The tree that my mother planted for my daughter when she was born, the front steps that my father and my uncle built so many years ago. And I looked in the window and I even saw my parents' bookshelf. They had left it behind. 10 minutes ago, I would have been like, oh my God, I gotta let them know. They need that. That's theirs. They should have it. And now I just realized it was just an ordinary item. And if they really wanted it, they would have taken it with them. And so out of the house comes this young kid. He probably was in his mid-20s, I would say. And he climbs in the front seat. Now, I don't know about you, but anytime I've gotten into a cab or even an Uber, it's just kind of customary to get in the back seat. Not many people climb up front. But this guy did it without any hesitation. And I found that to be really endearing. And so he opens the door and he climbs in and he closes the door behind him and he says, hey man, how's your night going? And I said, dude, you have no idea. Time went on and slowly I started putting the pieces of my life back together. And the following spring, I saved up everything that I could, and I sold what I didn't need, and moved my family, my wife and kids. We moved to North Carolina, where the rest of my family was, because I knew that there really wasn't much for me left in Bangor, Maine. And so we moved. And my wife is now, she's a beloved teacher at the school that my kids go to. That was an awesome, lucky break. And I now have a career that I'm proud of. I'm no longer addicted to benzos. Every now and again, I'll have a little bout of depression. But I always remember that one single night where everything just started to make sense. I no longer feel like I'm alone. I feel like there's always somebody, whether living or dead, that is out there looking after my best interest and helping me get through this crazy thing we call life. And so I guess that's kind of one of the reasons why I wanted to share this story, is because even when we feel like we're at our lowest, we just got to believe that we can keep moving forward. And I'm extremely lucky to have my beliefs, and especially lucky for this particular experience. I feel great now. I don't feel as anchored to all that negativity and unresolved anguish from my past. I even went out and found an old International Scout that I can fix up just to keep the memory of that time in my life alive. I mean, this thing is covered in rust. It's going to take a miracle to get it roadworthy again. But it's something that I can work on and enjoy. Maybe my son will help me as he grows older. Maybe we can fix it up together. Maybe he'll even drive it someday. For me, life is good. Actually, life is fucking amazing. Thank you.
This is Risk. This is Summer Heart behind me now. And we just heard from Rick Haney. You can go and find him on the Remotely One podcast, which entertains and educates people with stories about remote work. You can also find him at rickhaney.me. Folks, on Thursday, we're rerunning an episode from 2012 called Everybody Naked, but that's Thursday. And folks, today's the day. Take a risk.